for the ELCA Churchwide Offices. I'm Director of Studies in the Division for Church and Society, which means I work with the department that develops the social statements of the ELCA. And this particular statement on abortion is one of the first three social statements of the ELCA passed at our convention or churchwide assembly in 1991. And so what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about that, but before I do, let me just say a few things about what we understand social statements as being in the ELCA. We have a procedural document that talks about social statements and in a sense sets down some ground rules. And I think especially because people from different faith traditions might have different understandings of what that might mean. For example, Roman Catholics might think of this as like canon law, you have to believe this, and other understandings of what officially adopted statements of the church mean. I thought I'd read just two brief paragraphs to give you an idea of what a social statement is intended to be in the ELCA. This document goes on and on, talks about how they're theological documents, they're teaching documents, they engage in doing ethics, they set forth the position of this church on some social issue and a variety of things like that. But I think these paragraphs are especially important. Social statements hope to reflect the qualities of a community of forgiven sinners called to do God's will. I'm not reading from the document in front of you, but another one right now. They probe for shared convictions and the boundaries of faithful action, and within that framework, they acknowledge diversity. They recognize the complexity of society and the power of sin, as well as the responsibility of this church to speak and act with hope and boldness. And then it talks about the various disciplines of theology, ethics, the social sciences, etc., that are drawn upon. And then this word about church members and what members of the ELCA are to do with such things called social statements. Church members are called upon to give them serious consideration as they form their own judgment. In other words, these are not intended to say, oh, well, now we don't have to think through these issues. We just take the church's word and that's it. But they are to contribute to the kind of reflection and thinking about these issues that members of the church are called upon to do. The authority of statements is persuasive, not coercive. Their teaching function builds upon and seeks to nurture the freedom of Christians to decide and act responsibly. They help shape the conscience of Christians by appealing to their faith, moral convictions, and reason. I say that because as we're going through this, I want to make it very clear that this statement is presented in a spirit of something that you can argue with, not something you kind of say, oh, well, I'm not sure I agree with that. But they are intended to contribute to that ongoing deliberation as we struggle with issues that are complex, that cannot easily be resolved, and certainly issues on which there is a lot of division in our society. I don't think I have to say much about that matter of abortion being a highly divisive issue in our society. But let me use that as a way of moving into saying something about the task force that worked on this particular social statement. The task force was appointed in 1990 and really had a very short time frame to work to develop this statement. We met for about five times. I was a staff person that worked with the task force. And just to give you a sense of the kind of array of people on it, we had theologians, ethicists, parish pastors, homemakers, teachers, counselors, social workers, nurses, a physician, a public policy person. There were about 15 people, so I probably have exhausted the categories. And certainly they were people who had widely different positions on abortion. I would say for many of the people, I'm not quite sure exactly what their position was, because many people were saying, well, I think this way, but I also think that way. I don't have a real hard, fast position. But I think it is fair to say that there were people on the task force who would definitely identify themselves as pro-choice, and certainly there were people who would very definitely identify themselves as pro-life. For example, we had one of the founders of Lutherans for Life, which is a pro-life organization among Lutherans, and also another person who is presently on the board of Lutherans for Life. So certainly that spectrum was represented, and certainly there were also strongly pro-choice voices represented. I think some of the most powerful voices on the task force, quite frankly, were those of African American and Hispanic women, particularly a Hispanic woman who works with pregnant, poor teens. And therefore, there was a lot of reality in there and a lot of real concern that this not just be some nice white middle class kind of issue that we were talking about. So I'll try and point out some places where there were some real attempts to bring in some perspectives that spoke to the kind of reality that they were living with. First of all, let me just see if there's any questions about how the general, about the task force or about what a social statement is. I don't want to get into great length in that because our time is limited, but I wanted you to get a sense that this wasn't just something that came out of a vacuum or that a staff person developed, but it really was a statement that was drafted by a group that was very diverse. Any questions right now?
Well, the task force work isn't the end of it. It does go out to the church
That's
for
right.
comment. You had hearings.
Now get on to that.
We're
yeah.
going to talk about that.
Right. Yeah, we developed an early draft of this. Some of you might have seen it. It was a 8.5 by 11 kind of thing called Abortion, A Call to Deliberate. And it had two columns. One of the columns had questions running along the side to encourage people in local congregations to talk about the many factors involved in decision-making regarding abortion. And that particular draft resulted in lots of feedback. My estimate is we probably heard from about 2,000 people in the process of that. Some of them were people in local congregations who studied it and who wrote to us and expressed their concerns and their reactions. Some of them very strong reactions, some of them very helpful reactions, some of them not very helpful. And then we had a number of hearings. I think it was approximately 9 hearings at different places around the country where people could express their perspectives directly to those of us who were involved with the task force. And then we revised the document and basically fairly similar to what you have here. That was then sent out to all of our synods and distributed in the spring of 91 at all the synod assemblies. And then in August of 91 is when the churchwide assembly dealt with this. We came to that assembly somewhat nervous because, quite frankly, some of us who had worked on this didn't want to have to spend another 2 years dealing with this issue. And yet we realized that the nature of this issue in our society and also in our church is such that we were naive if we expected that something could easily make it through an assembly. And especially because social statements require a two-thirds majority vote. In other words, they're not something that can just squeak through with a bare majority, but there has to be a substantial support for the document. We were very surprised because the tone at the assembly was one of a lot of affirmation of what the statement tried to do, especially to get us beyond some of the rhetoric on this issue. And after many hours of discussion, most of it in a very helpful kind of tone and trying to sharpen the document rather than necessarily strong opposition to the document, it ended up being adopted by approximately a 90% majority at the churchwide assembly. Now, I don't think our church body is that different from American society in general. And so the fact that this was adopted by approximately a 90% majority, I'd say approximately because there were some procedural things so that the actual vote wasn't quite that high, and then there was a straw vote, people said, yeah, but over 90% of us aren't supportive of it, was, I think, a rather interesting kind of development. So let me walk through it, and I want to allow some time because I know there's probably lots of strong feelings about this particular matter, and I assume some reactions that many of you will have to this. So I'll try to go through this as quickly as I can and give you some sense of the logic of why this particular kind of statement is presented in the way that it is. The first part talks about our unity and diversity in Christ. And that is not just a nice little preface to it, to the main substance of this, but much of what is said in there was something that very much became a reality as the task force struggled and worked together on this document. We said again and again that in the midst of our incredible diversity, and I mean diversity because of the kind that these were people who normally never would have wanted to talk with one another, that somehow we were united in Christ, and our, especially our worship times as a task force became incredibly important because we said, hey, it's that, that is what enables us to talk together and to share our experiences and to be honest with one another and to call one another to account. That did not mean that it was always a nice conversation. At times things got rather hot. At times there were some who said, I don't like how rudely I was just treated. And there were some moments of real confrontation to make sure that we heard one another and didn't just pass lightly over comments that one voice or another might have had. So this notion of unity and diversity was something that the task force felt very strongly. In a closing Eucharist, the young Hispanic woman who I was making reference to before, in the midst of a participatory homily, was people were sharing some of their experiences of being on the task force. And she said, you know, I really appreciated getting to know my sisters on this task force. And one of the men said, well, what about your brothers? She said, yeah, my brothers also. And then she looked at one of the men that she had had some of the most severe disagreements with. Yeah, because I can fight with him just like I fight with my brother and know that somehow he's still my brother. And it was that kind of testimony to the kind of a sense of what enabled us to hang together even in the midst of some pretty sharp differences. And so the whole first part says something about that unity in Christ. Under B, because we are united in Christ through faith, we have both the freedom and the obligation to engage in serious deliberation on moral matters. Again and again in the ELCA, we've been trying to emphasize this theme of what it means for the church to be a community of moral deliberation. And I think that especially is true when we deal with an issue like abortion. Second page, part C, talking about our differences. We discovered, as the first draft of this was discussed, that abortion is usually not the only deep felt issue at stake when abortion is the topic of discussion. And so that first paragraph mentions some of the other things that people are likely to be feeling very deeply when they discuss this. Convictions about the social order, about the roles of women and men, about human life and human responsibility, freedom and limits, sexual morality, the significance of children. And therefore, there's a lot of very deep experiential things that come to the fore when we discuss these issues. I still think that one of the key things that made it possible for us to see beyond some of our differences is that the very first meeting in groups of two, we did some sharing of some of the important experiences and values that have most affected our positions on this issue. And that involved teaming up people that we knew had very different views on this. I'm thinking of one pastor who basically came to the first meeting feeling that all of, you know, any doctor who in any way would participate in an abortion was, you know, an all, you know, was a baby killer. And he ended up being teamed up that first night with the OBGYN physician who has been performing therapeutic abortions for some time. And the interesting thing is those two were continually striking up conversations through the course of the task force. There was something that happened between the two of them, even though if I could say what two people were most apart when we began, it probably was, were those two individuals. So how do we share some of those experiences and some of those concerns that we have that, that have a lot of effect on the actual positions that we might have on abortion? Then the second paragraph under Part C is a particularly strategic one, because this is the kind of strategic decision we made as a task force to try to move beyond the usual rhetoric that is used in talking about this issue in our society. And so we began by saying, well, yeah, there's the value of unborn life, but there's also the value of the woman and her other relationships. There's the moral seriousness of the decision faced by the woman, and there's also the moral value of the newly conceived life. There's moral claims on both sides, which again and again is what makes this such a complex issue. We also suggested early on that it's not helpful to use the language of rights in absolute ways that imply no other significant moral claims intrude. And so we came to this statement: a developing life in the womb does not have an absolute right to be born, nor does a pregnant woman have an absolute right to terminate a pregnancy. That was part of our process of searching for some common ground. Now, clearly, that is a statement that some people on both sides of this debate would find very difficult to accept. But it was an important breakthrough as we began to struggle to search for some common ground. So the concern for both the life of the woman and the life in her womb expresses a common commitment to life. Both of that is, you know, that, that all is pro-life, not using it in the usual way it's used in the debate, but you know, for life of the woman, yes, also for the developing life in her womb. So a real commitment then that we made to try to avoid using pro-life versus pro-choice language. What I found fascinating at the churchwide assembly as attempts were made to amend this is that most of those attempts really wanted to honor this basic principle, namely we don't want to fall into the usual rhetoric. So for example, you'll notice later on there was an attempt to say, well, we're against abortion as a means of birth control. Well, some people said, hey, you know, that's some of the rhetoric that gets thrown out about that. So we aren't so sure that we want that in the statement, because we want a statement that tries to move us beyond some of the code words that are used in the debate on this. So let me just move on in here and try to indicate how the statement as it moves along tries to honor that kind of strategic decision that the task force made. The next section, convictions of our faith, in each of these paragraphs, what the statement tries to do is to say something about some central theological understandings, but to do so in a way that, again, moves beyond some of the polarized debate. First, what do we say about human beings? Human beings are persons of intrinsic worth and dignity, but who are also responsible and accountable to God, self, and others. And so therefore, there's an attempt to say something about, yes, the intrinsic worth of all human beings, but also at the same time, or in the same breath, that part of what it means to be created in God's image is to be responsible decision makers, to act responsibly in the face of the challenges that we face. And certainly acting responsibly, particularly in the face of unintended pregnancies. Second paragraph deals with this whole matter of, well, yeah, isn't all of life a gift from God, and when does life begin, and that endless kind of debate of who's going to determine when life begins. This was certainly something the task force struggled with a lot, and what we came up with is this way of articulating it, the middle part of that paragraph. Personal human life is a part of the life that God creates, redeems, and fulfills in the coming reign of God. God creates life, but God creates life, creates a human being through complex genetic, physiological, and relational developments. Human life in all phases of its development is God-given, and therefore has intrinsic value, worth, and dignity. In other words, we were not going to get caught in saying, well, at this point it has value, and at that point it doesn't. So it was an attempt to say, yeah, all of that has worth, and yet at the same time we also need to look at what science, and especially embryology, has to teach us about the evolving, unfolding, developing nature of human life. And some of the data that we drew upon is in the footnote that appears on the next page. So that life is God-given, and at the top of the next page we need to respect and care for the life that God gives. The third paragraph in this section, I'm on now the top of page 3. Those of you who came in late, if you can look over somebody's shoulder, or it'd be helpful to be able to follow along on this a little bit. Here's where the statement tries to say something about sin. Certainly, one of the questions that comes up again and again in the debate about abortion is, well, is the church going to pronounce this a sin or not? I think it's very interesting that the most conservative members of our task force were very reluctant to say every abortion is a sin, and certainly were very reluctant to somehow brand every woman who has an abortion with a scarlet A, saying, ah, she has sinned by having an abortion. And yet certainly we did not in any way want to downplay the reality of sin, as it is a pervasive reality in all of the dilemmas that we face in life. And so this is an attempt to talk about sin both as a condition of alienation from God and the acts that issue from that condition. And as that paragraph goes on, I think it's important to recognize that it tries to look at sin as it's manifested in the many ways human beings are not given equal respect or treated with high value. That's not just in terms of having an abortion, but it's the many situations that a woman faces where she herself has been sinned against, terms of the injustices and the realities that she faces. And so the last portion of that paragraph, we both sin and are sinned against. Sin is a pervasive reality, but at the same time, the statement does not try to somehow single out abortion as the sin and somehow raise it up for special attention apart from the wider sinful condition within which abortions are often chosen. Then the fourth and fifth paragraphs say something about repentance, forgiveness, sanctification, the importance of grace, no matter what decision is made, the importance of doing justice, loving mercy, walking humbly with our God, serving the needs of the neighbor, and especially those who are most vulnerable. obviously, a lot more could be said theologically about these matters, but we were trying to be as brief as we could and to try to set forth some foundations theologically that we could build on in the rest of the statement. Part three. I'd like to suggest that part three is really sets forth the basic position of the ELCA on these matters. It's not often the position that people turn to first, but I think it's important to understand what the statement is saying in this section on the church as a community supportive of life. The very bottom of the text on page three, the strong Christian presumption is to preserve and to protect life. And therefore, from that perspective, abortion ought to be an option only of last resort. I think if there's a central ethical judgment in here, I would say that sentence is probably it. The difficulty, however, is that indeed abortion is experienced to be the last option in an awful lot of situations in our society. And therefore, the central strategy that is set forth in this section of the document is that we as a church need to work to reduce the need to turn to abortion as the answer to unintended pregnancy. That, in a sense, is the central strategy set forth here. And so it goes on deploring the circumstances that lead a woman to consider abortion as the best option available to her. Situations of poverty, of isolation, of her youth, sexism, racism, a number of things mentioned in that paragraph. It's also interesting that this is where there is a confession of sin in this next paragraph. We confess our sin as a community of faith. And there was real consensus on the task force of that. We cannot go around pointing our finger unless we as a church community are serious about addressing the conditions in our society that lead to a number of abortions. We have fallen short in respecting God's gift of life and in providing conditions more conducive for bringing new life into the world. So there's a number of things that we as the Christian community need to be more serious about, and I'll just quickly mention some of those. You can read them at your leisure. Trying to focus on long-term as well as immediate needs. A ministry of hospitality toward those who bear and raise children under all kinds of conditions throughout congregational life and church policy. Here we spend a lot of time talking about the fact that, well, how welcoming are we to that single mother and the struggle that she goes through? And how can we get serious about addressing that in terms of how our congregations live out their ministry of hospitality to people who might have children under circumstances that some of the members of our congregations might have great difficulties with. By our policies and practices, we need to indicate we are truly supportive of children through the long years after, not only before they are born. Are children really welcome in our church? Do we indicate that? Lots of expressions of our church life. Next paragraph takes a fairly conservative position, saying, yes, marriage is the appropriate context for sexual intercourse. And yet at the same time, we recognize that sexual intercourse does go on in situations other than a married relationship. When sexual intercourse occurs apart from the intent to conceive, the use of contraceptives is the responsibility of the man as well as the woman. At this point and two or three other places, there was a real concern to say we've got to especially emphasize sexual responsibility among men in our society. This actually was changed, modified a little bit at the churchwide assembly because people wanted it to be balanced in terms of women and men. So where the task force had accentuated men, it was put in a more balanced way in the amending. And something about sex education. And then the first full paragraph on the top of page 5, parenthood as a shared vocation, educating males to raise children as well as females, parenting groups and support groups for fathers as well as for mothers. And then finally, a word about the pervasive life-degrading attitudes in our society that we as a task force felt were certainly contribute to the high incidence of abortion in our society. But again, rather than saying, well, that person is selfish because she chose an abortion, it's a matter of saying, how do we look at the wider social milieu within which individualism and materialism and the desire for perfect children and desire not to be inconvenienced, those kinds of factors. How do we address those wider factors in our society and not simply engage in some finger pointing? So through these and other efforts, we as a church seek to reduce the need to turn to abortion as the answer to unintended pregnancies. Now I think there's a lot of stuff in there that's already happening in a lot of congregations. There's probably also a number of things in there that a lot of congregations could get much more serious about. So I think there's a big agenda there for members of our congregations to tackle if in fact we are to be a community that is truly supportive of life. I'm getting a little long-winded here, so let me try to move a little more quickly through these two next sections. Making decisions regarding unintended pregnancies. This is probably the section that people gravitate toward most quickly to say, well, what is the ELCA's position? But I think it's more complex than might appear to be on the surface initially. First of all, it talks about church members walking with and listening to those who are facing this dilemma. It talks in the next paragraph about the kind of counsel that should be provided, counsel that is respectful of the integrity of the woman and others who are involved and respects how deeply the pregnancy involves the woman's whole person in relation to all the commitments of her life, the very bottom of page 5, and seeks to call forth her power to act responsibly. In other words, not to decide for her, but to walk with her, to provide competent, helpful guidance for her as she struggles with that decision and struggles with it with the man and others who may be involved with her. But regardless of the decision, our response, and I'm on the top of page 6 now, must be a gracious affirmation of the value of women's lives and assistance in dealing with the ongoing implications of that decision, whichever way she decides. So it moves on from there saying, in most cases, this church encourages women to continue the pregnancy, recognizing that that needs to be done with a realistic assessment of what's involved. It also encourages adoption as a positive option while trying to, at the same time, recognize that's not always that easy either. That's not necessarily the answer for all unintended pregnancies, but certainly it's an option that needs to be given far more serious consideration than may at times be the case. Then finally, the tough issue of ending a pregnancy. This church recognizes that there can be sound reasons for having an abortion. Conscientious decisions, bottom of page 6, need to be made in relation to difficult circumstances that vary greatly. In other words, it is very hard to have hard and fast rules that apply to every situation. What is determined to be morally responsible in one situation may not be in another. To some degree, we're dealing with something that is necessarily a case-by-case kind of decision. But it goes on at this point to identify three situations where we as a task force, and I think we as a church body, are able to reach fairly clear consensus about situations where an abortion is morally acceptable. Now, there was a little bit of modifying of the statement at this point, and so it makes it maybe less clear than it was originally when it came from the task force. But at least the way I interpreted it at this point is that these are situations that are illustrative of morally acceptable situations, not intended to be exhaustive, but to say, this is where we as a church body agree that yes, abortion is morally responsible or acceptable in these situations, namely clear threat to the physical life of the woman, situations where both parties don't participate willingly in sexual intercourse, most particularly in cases of rape and incest, although the paragraph expands it beyond just those situations. And then situations where there's extreme fetal abnormality and where there will be very early death of an infant if the infant is brought to term. So those are the situations that are named on that end of things. The next paragraph also goes on to make a statement on the other end. This church opposes ending interuterine life when a fetus is developed enough to live outside a uterus with the aid of reasonable and necessary technology. And one of the criteria there, which is given in the sentence that precedes it, is that at that point it becomes possible for other people and not only the mother to nourish and care for the child. So those are some of the parameters that are set, recognizing that ELCA members continue to be at different places in between those parameters. Then finally, the public policy issues on abortion. And here is where I suppose there's some frustration because people would like to say, well, in terms of recent Supreme Court decision, we'd like to say, well, this is where our church stands, or we'd like to be able to say, is our church going to support Roe v. Wade or support those who would get rid of Roe v. Wade? And I don't think it's a real clear, simple kind of answer that one can turn to in terms of this. But at the same time, I think there are some helpful things said here for the public debate. I was mentioning in passing yesterday that after the recent Supreme Court decision, I ended up talking on the radio to reporters connected with UP, Associated Press, and CBS because they all were interested in how some of the church bodies who've addressed this issue, how some of our attempts to find common ground might have a relationship to this issue as it's being debated and in light of the recent Supreme Court decision. And I think there is some relationship to that, even though it's not a matter of being able to set a real clear and definitive answer to some of the questions that are raised. First of all, in terms of public policy, there's a lot of attention given here to the matter of support for life, both before and after birth, in terms of health care, child care, housing, sufficient income support, support for education, nutrition, services that protect children from abuse and neglect, maternity and paternity leaves, flexibility in the workplace. In other words, a lot of those factors that presently make it very difficult for many women to realistically think of bringing new life into the world. How can we as a society get much more serious about addressing those kinds of factors? Then it goes on to address the matter of the regulation of abortion. And the task force reached a point of saying, okay, government does have a legitimate role in regulating abortion. Now, that very sentence could cause some people to say, oh, yeah, this is clearly a pro-life kind of statement. I don't think that's quite fair, although certainly in terms of the way the public debate shapes up, when you see that kind of statement, it kind of tends to fit into that particular pocket. What it goes on from there, though, is to say there's real difficulty, though, in that matter of trying to say now how, what kind of regulatory role can there be, especially in a way that recognizes the complex situations involved and the highly diverse situations within which this decision is faced. And so it tries to raise up some of those difficult, problematic tensions involved in trying to reach any agreement as to what is an adequate and fair and effective and just way of trying to regulate abortion in our society. Laws should be enacted and enforced justly for the preservation and enhancement of life and should avoid unduly encumbering or endangering the lives of women. Also, I would point to the bullet on the top of page 10 because the statement also opposes laws that are primarily intended to harass those contemplating or deciding for an abortion. Now, certainly there would be many voices saying that any of the attempts to regulate abortion end up doing that. And so there's a lot of need for reading through this and reflecting on it and saying, well, now what really would be the effect of that piece of legislation? And so this is really an attempt to help us think through and to work with legislators and others who would be involved in that process to reflect on some of the factors involved and to do so in a somewhat thoughtful kind of way. Top of page 10, for those three reasons identified earlier, where there is rather clear consensus that an abortion is morally acceptable, the stance here is that abortion for those reasons should not be prohibited by law or by lack of public funding, because the lack of public funding for poor women effectively prohibits it, even if legally it's allowed. And on the other hand, a position is taken here prohibiting or supporting legislation that prohibits abortion after the fetus is determined to be viable. But beyond these situations, this church officially, and I'm talking about the kind of public policy advocacy work that could be done on the basis of this statement, neither supports nor opposes laws prohibiting abortion. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean that individual members might not take their own stances and work one way or the other on that, but in terms of official ELCA advocacy work, those are the kind of parameters that are set forth here. And then this final one just kind of indicates some of the ongoing things that we need to continue to struggle with, particularly the matter of spouse consultation, parental consent, and public funding of abortions beyond those three reasons cited earlier. So, sorry to take so much time laying that out, but I wanted to at least give you a little more of what's behind the words on the page and what things the task force felt particularly strongly about. You'll also notice at the end here, this little addendum, we are required to indicate where in the process of considering this statement at the assembly there was a significant percentage, and it's approximately 20% or more, who felt strongly about one matter or another and tried to amend it in one way or the other. So you can see a little bit of what unfolded on the convention floor as people tried to propose some amendments which did not actually get adopted. So these were not part of the statement, but it gives you a little lens into the proceedings of some changes that were attempted. So, comments, questions, reactions, protests. But certainly wasn't an attempt to water down sin or to take it less seriously. But it was, I think, an attempt to consider those situations where a woman might find herself in some very oppressive kinds of situations, ends up getting pregnant in the midst of that, probably having some responsibility for that, you know, not that she's without responsibility, but there's a number of factors that might be a part of that whole social context of, you know, if she's a young teenager from an abusive family, you know, number of the kind of motivations of why she might have said, yeah, might as well have sexual intercourse with this guy. Trying to, again, see sin in more than just an individual, the responsibility of the individual, but say, yeah, there's also social, structural, systemic kinds of factors that are there too, which doesn't absolve the individual personal responsibility, but it tries to say it's a both and kind of situation that's operating.
I'm in the medical profession, and I see every day at least one or two patients who have had anywhere from 1 to 7 abortions. And I think your statement is very impressive. It's very inclusive. It covers just about everything you can cover. So I want to commend you for that. Like I said, it's a very complex issue. I got to depends on the individual situation. I think you covered as much as you possibly can. I mean, the range is so wide from 11-year-old to 11-year-old, or 9-year-old to 11-year-old to 37-year-old, and I'm an older, so and married, unmarried, and not having the parents, and not coming until the day they deliver, and not showing anybody, so it's a very, very complex issue. And I appreciate all the support that you're coming to.
Karen?
That thing that I appreciate most of what you say is the fact that it puts the whole abortion issue in terms of a continuing timeline beyond just the point of the actual pregnancy. And you know, for me, that makes the biggest difference of all. And I think it becomes the most compelling moral underpinning for the kind of positions that and the kinds of recommendations that are made here. We're talking about not just what occurs during the pregnancy itself, but being concerned about what happens to those children once they are born. I guess I see within society as a whole a real reluctance to deal with those kinds of realities, and I'm especially upset with those who push for one particular extreme solution and not pay any attention to the kinds of consequences once those things occur, and you know, with some people advocating against funding for the kinds of things that are really necessary. You know, I think for me, that really puts the statement over the top in terms of fairly dealing with the complexity of the issue.
Let me get him in first and then I'll check.
On page 7, where it refers to dehumanizing conditions, certain circumstances of conception being dehumanizing, I think we have to be somewhat careful now with all of the different ways that conception occurred, that are some of which are just basically clinical, you know, test tube babies and artificial insemination. I think we have to be careful with the language there, that people that are products of these kinds of conceptions that, you know, the church might look upon as less than sacred. I don't know if there's anything sacred about a laboratory, but I guess maybe it would be, but I think we have to be somewhat careful about the language that we use as far as what we see as human or sacred and what we use not, for the sake of those who are products of those other kinds of conceptions.
Well, that's an interesting point. I don't think it's occurred to me in connection with that paragraph, because dehumanizing is being used in that sentence to refer to the previous sentences, you know, which were dealing with the situations of domination and oppression that some women find themselves in. And that very much came out of some very real life testimony. For example, in some cultures, if a woman tries to get birth control, she can be severely beaten by her husband, you know, because that is just taboo. And then, of course, she gets pregnant, and it may be a very violent, broken kind of relationship. And so there, this was an attempt to say, hey, we need to be very realistic about some of the really tough situations that people are facing, and that those situations themselves are dehumanizing. But your caution there is an important one when we're looking at those other issues of.
On page 8, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Howard.
Well, you said a goal of the process was to try to get beyond the public rhetoric, particularly of the poles, of the spectrum, and to use some different kinds of language and to come out with what there was consensus on, you know, the wide spectrum within our church, within the ELCA. Has that been successful? Particularly, I'm interested in what the reaction is to this document from the vocal pole areas of the debate.
I have heard very, very few reactions. We have gotten a few letters from people of a very extreme pro-life position saying, you know,
you sold out.
You sold out, etc. I have also heard from some of my strongly pro-choice friends who have said, well, you just totally sold out and one won't even talk to me anymore. And so there certainly have been some who are not that happy with it. At the same time, I continually have to say this is a corporate product, this is an expression, a communal expression of a church body, and therefore to presume that it's going to adequately reflect the position of any of us who were part of this, or any one member is, it may not in fact do that, but I think it was the best attempt to try to say something in a together kind of way as a church.
And as nearly as you can tell from the response so far, it is affirmed by the grassroots of the ELCA.
Yeah, I think so. As an example, a few months ago, I was invited to preach and lead a forum on it in a church not too far from Chicago that has literally been split apart by Operation Rescue demonstrations. And a son of the congregation is the head of the Operation Rescue stuff going on in that community.
What is it?
Aurora.
What is Operation Rescue?
Oh, Operation Rescue is, well, they're the group that has tried to shut down.
They were in Wichita?
Wichita,
yeah. and Buffalo.
Tried to shut down.
Yeah.
And in this case, they did some pretty violent attacking of the doctor, his clinic, chaining his car and pouring acid all over it and, all kinds of stuff that was going on. Well, the doctor's also a member of this congregation. And so we had an adult forum, the parents of the parents were there whose son leads the Operation Rescue. He wasn't there. They expected a major confrontation, but Operation Rescue called off their troops that day. And the doctor was there, and it was amazing. They were able to talk about this and to say, well, yeah, we can live together. So that was an interest, one of the more interesting test cases that I've been in terms of this particular. I'm not saying we had Operation Rescue there and that they were going to say yes to this, but I think it has helped to heal some of those, or at least speak to people who are in the broad middle between some of those extremes.
I was going to say, as a labor and delivery nurse, I see patients. Almost every woman I see has had at least one abortion, if not seven. Many have had two or three. They come from all socioeconomic groups, all different races, religions. And it surprises me. Every time I pull out my OB history, I notice everyone's had one or two tabs. It's very common. And I think by having a statement like this, that you open up dialogue. You allow a woman at the age of 19 who's in college, who's pregnant, who really maybe doesn't want to have an abortion, but doesn't see a big option, doesn't see, you know, I can't go home to my mom and dad, I don't want to carry this pregnancy in term because I don't have any support, I can't finish college. That maybe with statements like this, more women will be able to come and will be able to make a more supportive choice. You know, and if they want to carry their child in term, that there will be more supports open to them.
We're hoping there could be some helpful material developed on the basis of this. You know, for example, even the little leaflets that can be left in the leaflet rack, you know, that could catch the eye of someone who's not about to go to a pastor and say, oh, what is our church's statement on abortion? But where some of the understandings here could be presented in a popular kind of way, it might be helpful to a woman who's struggling silently with some of this.
Yeah, and I the women that I deal with, I don't believe in, regardless of whether, you know, we all believe it's our right and our own reproductive rights, and, you know, believe strongly in that, but I don't think anybody wants to have an abortion and feels good about it. And I think that to be supported in the post factor is important for the community.
I was going to say, make a comment on page 8 under B, the support for life after birth. My church doesn't minister to youth, you know, teenagers, children, or other. And I think that we need to go out and try to help that for these unwanted babies that are born anyway, and to help the children in our church. And then the public. Everything is being cut, at least in California, it is being cut. Programs for kids are the first to be cut. And this statement is beautiful, but it's meaningless to me, who is very involved in the public schools and the public, you know, I mean, we support the public stuff, but it's being cut. And we need to speak out and really make a statement for the kids. I mean, we don't care about the kids.
Well,
one other thing in here that really bothers me about, where was it? This church opposes ending intrauterine life when a fetus is developed enough to live outside a uterus with the aid of reasonable and necessary technology. I am not for having a baby born and staying alive on a machine. Just like I'm opposed to having an older person who could die being kept alive on a machine.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in part, the words reasonable and necessary, which were actually added by a member of the church council who herself is a nurse, and that mm-hmm. ended up being adopted then at the churchwide assembly, was an attempt to speak to the second of the two situations, well, to address the concern that you're raising. They're mm-hmm. obviously reasonable and necessary, you know. Yeah. That's those are pretty elastic terms,
right?
But it was an attempt to say that this does not mean all-out technology to spend the millions and millions mm-hmm. in the first year of life to keep that child alive. So again, there's no real hard and fast line here, but it's an attempt to say, no, we're not saying all out technology, no matter what.